Hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. Do you want to introduce ourselves?
Sure. I'm Liz Mayer. I'm a blogger. I also am an online communications consultant working with various political and public affairs candidates, and I'm also the former RNC online communications director.
And I am Rebecca Traister. I'm a senior writer at Salon.com. I'm the author of the forthcoming book, Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. All right.
That's us.
So, speaking of American women.
Yeah.
We have both been writing recently about women in politics.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times with my friend and colleague Anna Holmes this weekend, in which I talked a little bit about how progressives share some of the blame for what Anna Holmes and I perceive as the blame for Sarah Palin's rapid ascendancy and the way that she has become a kind of unchallenged poster child for American women in politics. I don't know if you have, I suspect that you had some reactions to that op-ed, and I have been reading you on the topic of how liberal women talk about the Republican women who are currently heading for office. So I thought that might be a productive place to start today.
Sure. I mean, I think first thing that I would say is I read your op-ed, and I actually thought that there were some very valid points that were made in that. I have been a little bit surprised, given the way that progressives and progressive women in particular like to talk about women's issues and women's rights and women generally. I've been a little bit surprised at the fact that, I guess in my opinion, I haven't seen as many strong Democratic women stepping forward, and particularly in a year that's being called the Year of the Woman, stepping forward and running for office. We have some instances, to be sure, but I think your point, it felt to me, was a little bit like, you know, progressive women have in some regards taken a little bit of a back step, and that's not necessarily a positive thing overall, and I think that's probably correct. The reason I would say it's correct is because I actually think that there's a huge glut of political talent out there on both sides of the aisle, and if women are stepping back, we're potentially missing out on that a little bit as a country. And I think, you know, as far as what I was writing in my piece about how liberal women, and actually not just women, liberals and progressives talk about conservative women and how they perceive them, I just feel like increasingly we're getting to a point where there's a constant tendency to try to peg women and define women as one thing. And actually, we're a pretty diverse group of people. We have diverse interests, diverse objectives, and diverse experiences, all of which I think play a valuable role when you're looking at the public sphere. But I'm kind of getting tired of the pigeonholing, I guess, was where I was going with what I wrote.
Well, I guess that there are there are a bunch of things you just said that I want to unpack. The first, with regard to my op-ed, is I would say, I want to refine your assessment of my argument a little bit. Mm-hmm. I actually don't think that Democratic women have taken a step back. In fact, I've written quite a bit about the fact that I think that the 2008 election, the candidacy of Hillary Clinton, and all the back and forth that it provoked, which was intense and in many ways dismaying, actually represented a giant step forward for American women, and I believe Sarah Palin's candidacy was a part of that as well, and that it expanded the ways in which we began to perceive women in politics, which I think is tremendously valuable and important toward putting more women in office in the future. The thing that I would say is that I don't think there has, on the Democratic side, I think the Year of the Woman and the perception that 2010 is the Year of the Woman is a Republican perception, and not, there was an LA Times article this weekend that suggested that if Republicans, in fact, make the kind of congressional sweep that many people predict they will, the numbers of women in office are going to decline for the first time in many years, which is pretty depressing. But the Year of the Woman conceit is definitely about the number of Republican women who are running for office. It doesn't seem to have a huge application when it comes to the Democratic field, though there are certainly tremendously powerful Democratic and exciting young Democratic women out there. in all kinds of offices, state, national, federal. My complaint is more that I don't feel that the party, that the Democratic Party has done much work to acknowledge what is quite obviously to me a national appetite for female leadership. And for the kinds of expanding roles and expanding profiles of women in politics that we've seen, with everybody from Palin and the Mama Grizzlies to Hillary Clinton to Amy Klobuchar and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Jennifer Granholm, and with, you know, there are those women out there, but the Democratic Party hasn't worked to take advantage of that and find, groom, and present either the young women out there that they have who are terrifically smart and compelling as party leaders, or to discover and groom new young female candidates who can challenge Palin, the Mama Grizzlies, and their professed notions that they are, you know, the future, the present and future of women in politics. That's my complaint. It's not, I don't think we've moved backwards. I just don't think the Democrats are moving forwards far enough.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask, so, I mean, to me it sounds like, based on the way that you've just set that out there, your concern is that a lot of progress was made, particularly in 2008, and that maybe Democrats have just kind of let that linger, let that lie, without really doing a lot to build upon it or doing anything particularly with it, whereas we are seeing, I think, a lot of momentum and energy on the Republican side, and a lot of Republican women stepping up and likely to get elected to office. But that's just not something that has been a bipartisan enough trend, perhaps, from your perspective, that Democrats should be doing more?
That's exactly it. I think the progress that was made in 2008 had an enormous amount to do with changing and reshaping a public perception of what it could be to be a competitive woman in politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, we just had all our notions smashed by both Clinton and Palin. All the conventional wisdom about, you know, how we feel about women, how women behave when they're running for office, that was all challenged. It was, you know, just both of those women made a huge impact on how we perceive women in politics. So I think that the progress was a kind of progress amongst the electorate, and I don't think that the Democratic Party has responded with enough energy to it.
Yeah,
So that's exactly my complaint.
And I think that probably standing back and observing it from the other side of the aisle, I would generally agree with that. I think that there are obviously prominent women who are running for office on both sides of the aisle this year. I think that, you know, one of the things that I heard a lot coming out of the Florida primary recently was that Alex Sink, you know, her star actually might be a little bit more on the rise than what people had expected it to be, and she's been somebody who perhaps hasn't been covered and hasn't had the high profile that one might expect is somebody who's running for a major office like Florida governor. And that may be changing a little bit. So I think some of this might be situational as well, but I generally, standing back from it, agree with your assessment, quite frankly.
Many conservatives love it when Democrats are willing, you know, are eager to criticize their own party. There was a great reaction yesterday from many Democrats to my piece, mm-hmm. You know, accusing me of trying to do in my own party, which is always one of the things that makes it difficult to write a piece like that.
Well, heaven forbid that anybody should have an opinion and feel the need to express it, right? I get that all the time, too, so
I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do. If you try to agitate within the confines of your own party, then you often get accused of treachery. Mm-hmm. But I want to go to your point about the undermining, because I read your very interesting piece about what you perceive as the liberal reaction to the Republican women running, which I think is what you're talking about in terms of pigeonholing women as supposed to be something.
And I should preface this by saying that it is certainly by no means, I think, the majority of sort of liberal or progressive response to a lot of Republican women running and actually being in a position to win fairly high elected office this year, but it is something that I've noticed just a little bit more of than kind of what I expected to see and that I had hoped to see. I think that there has been a tendency from some commentators and actually, frankly, just some people that I know who aren't really out there in the public sphere to automatically say, well, if somebody is pro-life, then that means that they're anti-woman or that they're a man, effectively a man in a dress or a man in a skirt, as I titled the piece. you know, or to otherwise say, well, if you're conservative on a whole array of issues, you can't really be a woman. And I think that's something that's, you know, fairly noxious. If one of our objectives is actually to make sure that pretty much anybody in society is capable of participating within the political realm, especially, you know, those who have obvious demonstrable talent, I think that having that kind of preconception isn't particularly helpful. I think, you know, if you look at polling, certainly there are plenty of pro-life women out there. I don't personally happen to be one of them, but there are plenty of them. And I don't think that that perspective is necessarily less valid or you know, less exemplary of what makes you a woman or not. It just happens to be a different perspective on an issue that I think most people recognize is fairly important.
Well, I think I can address this kind of head on because I'm one of the people who has often leveled criticism at the Republican women who run on anti-choice platforms and who support policies that I also believe don't help other women. So I think in some ways I may be the person you're responding to, but I would like to, the point that I would make is that I would never say, nor do I believe that they're not women, that they're not real women. My argument is they're not feminists, and which is an argument that's germane when Palin and crew, as they have recently, you know, when they've begun throwing around the word feminist and feminist language with abandon. So that's my point when I talk about, for example, an anti-choice position and Republican women. And as for the question of whether or not being anti-choice or pro-life is anti-woman, my personal response, and of course there are a million possible responses, many of which I really respect, for me, I know many women who don't personally believe in abortion, who are anti-abortion, personally who would never have one, who don't believe it's right. But I do feel pretty strongly that when you're a politician in a vying for or in a position to make policy and you support curtailing reproductive rights for other women, either in accordance with your own personal beliefs or not, what you're doing is limiting the freedom and opportunity for professional, economic, and social equality, and that's why I consider it an anti-woman stance. I don't consider you not a woman if you're doing that. But I consider it a position that limits other women's opportunity to fully participate in the democracy. So that's why I have said, and will continue to say that it's an anti-feminist stance, but not that the women who propagated are not real women.
Yeah, and I guess I have a slightly different view on that. I mean, partly I think that my perspective on this is probably somewhat guided by things like there was an Atlantic piece that I actually linked to in my blog, Her Post, called The End of Men. And I think if you look at economic trends, women just aren't in the same place as where we were, you know, prior to me being born in the 1970s. We're not where we were in the 1980s. We're not where we were when I was a teenager. And I think that the extent to which having a baby is the result of an unplanned pregnancy impacts on your economic future. Clearly, if you're 13, I think it's going to. I think that's
or
fairly
if you're
inevitable.
Four.
But I think if you're 30, I think that that's a very different equation from where it was in the 1990s. So it's harder for me to look at that and see a direct connection. But I think fundamentally also, you know, I take your point, and I think that you raise valid points there. But I think, to me, the debate about abortion, at least if you're looking at it from the pro-life standpoint, is, you know, certainly I think that everybody accepts that to some degree, women's ability to do things with their body is impinged upon. But if you think that there are two lives at issue, not just one, then clearly you're going to have to adopt a slightly different approach in terms of balancing the rights that attach to both of those. So I guess I just see the fundamental debate a little bit differently. I mean, I personally am pro-choice. I don't think that Roe versus Wade was correctly decided. That's actually a decision or a view that I've held for a very, very long time, despite having, you know, gradually moderated, I guess, my perspective on abortion as an issue overall. You know, I guess my attitude about it is I'm very opposed to the idea of any sort of late-term abortion unless a mother's life is in jeopardy. But if we're talking about the first 2 to 3 months, I guess I think that, you know, the common sense perspective, in my opinion, is, well, maybe you better let people have their say in that particular instance. But, you know, I think also being in that sort of halfway house in a lot of regards maybe makes it easier for me to see where both people who are strongly pro-choice and people who are strongly pro-life are coming from, because I think that there are very valid arguments on both sides.
Let me go back a little bit to what you cited, Hannah Rosen's piece, The End of Men, and this idea that we live in a very different world than our mothers and certainly than our grandmothers inhabited mm-hmm. when it comes to the kinds of issues we're fighting about
yeah.
when we talk about women's rights and women's equality. I very much agree with that. I thought the Hannah Rosen piece was fascinating. I disagreed with a lot of it. There was a lot of very provocative stuff in there, stuff I've been thinking about, stuff people have been talking about. You know, of course, the danger in that piece, from my perspective, is selling a really overly rosy, or not rosy, overly grim, depending on who you're talking about,
sure.
Picture of gender relations. And the suggestion inside it, which was very provocative and very interesting, and I'm not saying is invalid, but that in fact is not quite true that women have triumphed in every area. I mean, we can look around and name a million places in which women are not dominating. But fundamentally, what I agree with in terms of what you're saying, and certainly what Hannah was saying, and this is something I've written about a lot at Salon, and also there's a chapter in my book about the differences between different generations of women and different generations of feminists specifically, mm-hmm. is that women our age were born into a very different world.
Yeah.
If you were born after or just before Roe, what you have is a whole different scope of possibility. But that, and different things you take for granted. But the things that you take for granted and your scope of possibility are there only because of Roe. I mean, really. And regardless, I know many people way, way left who also think Roe was, you know, the decision was flawed. You know, that's a very common line of argument. But the fact is that what it made possible for American women is what has given us our more relaxed attitude about reproductive rights, ironically enough. I don't know if that makes sense or not. But if we had lived in the world before Roe, we would have so much stronger feelings, possibly on either side, or, you know, you might be even more strongly pro-choice than you are. It would be a whole different world. And that's the world that often our mothers or grandmothers can't believe. You know, how can you not know this? Don't you know how imperiled you are? And this is a real communication gap between those generations. The thing I profoundly disagree with you, so I agree that when we have these conversations, they really are so much different than they were, you know, a couple of decades ago. What the freedoms of Roe have allowed us are to adopt a more relaxed attitude about reproductive rights and choice. If reproductive rights continue to be curtailed, we'll stop being so relaxed about it. And they haven't made my attitudes about it any more relaxed. I'm as far pro-choice as you can possibly get, I feel, sometimes. What I really disagree with you about is the idea that we've changed so much in the past few decades that we would now be immune to having a lack of reproductive freedom have an impact on us. That might be true if we were privileged, white, economically stable women who could still afford the kinds of health care and the kinds, and frankly, even if abortion were outlawed, could still get abortions. But I actually think that it would have a tremendous impact on economically disadvantaged women. And I think it's really vital that we not forget that in our calmness about if you're 30 and you have a baby, it's not going to have that much impact on you. That's definitely not true. If you're 30 and have a very tenuous source of income and you have a baby and it causes you to lose your job in this economy, I mean, that there are millions of women for whom it would make a deep, deep impact on their ability to earn their living, to participate in their profession, to pay for their families, to feed their families. And I think it's really important that we not let that go, even while we're noting the many ways in which women have progressed in recent decades.
But I think my point isn't necessarily that there wouldn't be individual people who would actually be impacted by a change in the law in that regard, in an economic fashion. My point is that the overall situation that we're looking at today is very different than the situation that we were looking at in the 1990s. I mean, that's when I was, I guess, a preteen and then a teenager. I personally feel the difference in when I look at people who are of that age now and when I look at people who are the age that I am now in that period. I feel that there is a difference, and I think that the data tends to bear that out. I mean, as far as jumping back to the Atlantic piece, I think your comment about whether what's depicted in that is, first of all, accurate, but second of all, and perhaps more importantly, actually a positive trend, I think is a really interesting question to debate because, A, I kind of wonder, on the one hand, while I'm all about women empowering themselves and women rising to a high level in the professional infrastructure and moving up the ladder and such, I kind of wonder whether the idea that one half of the species is becoming perhaps irrelevant is something that necessarily is a positive. And I also wonder about the ability that women really do have to have it all. I mean, I feel like when I look around now, there's a lot more capability for that kind of thing. But ultimately, you kind of do have to be superwoman. And I think in a lot of regards, the fact that we're seeing that sort of situation become a lot more normal than what it used to, that may actually create a lot of pressure on a lot of women who do want to have kids and they do want to have high-powered careers. And in some cases, the men aren't really there or they're just not fulfilling the role that perhaps, you know, we all grew up expecting them to. And I think that that whole societal trend is a very interesting thing. I think it's also interesting given that, you know, if you're looking at the current economic climate, it would appear that men are being more adversely affected by high rates of unemployment and job losses than women are. And I think that that's an interesting thing to consider, particularly given the political cycle that we're in.
You keep doubling and tripling up on issues I want to address, so I keep having to go back to the first thing you said and then work through it. Back again to the Hanna Rosin piece. That's your concern that one half, you know, that one gender is becoming irrelevant is the kind of thing that was problematic about that piece, but also obviously why it was so incendiary and got so much attention, is mm-hmm. that I think it's incredibly hyperbolic. I mean, phone me when yeah. men are not, you know, 83% of Congress and, you know, well, we're not at a point of male irrelevance right
also,
now.
Also, when I go home and tell my husband that I don't need him to hang around and help me with anything and he's completely not useful in my life, then I guess we'll know that men really are irrelevant. I don't think it's
right.
going to happen anytime
right.
soon, right? I mean, clearly men are not irrelevant. But I think still there are a few things in the piece that when you look at it in the round ring true on some level. And I don't know. You know, at the end of the day, people need to live their lives in a way that makes them happy. But I guess I just question, you know, whether that, and I guess this is going back to my overall point. I don't think that women are a uniform group. I don't think we're a homogenous group. So I'm not sure that any one policy or any one approach when it comes to your lifestyle is necessarily going to work for the entirety of the group. And seeing a trend like that makes you think about it a little bit.
Right. Well, I guess my response, and this is, you know, again, it's such an interesting thing because I really found the piece totally fascinating. And I think it's a very smart and provocative piece. That doesn't mean that I agree with it. And I do agree with some of its feminist critics who point out that it's exactly this kind of panic button pressing that has helped to sort of earn feminism its demonized reputation. I mean, these kind of myths mm-hmm. that what women were out for was domination rather than equality.
Right.
That was, has always been, except I'm sure in some very individual dominating cases, but that's always been a myth. I mean, and so the fear that in fact that was what women and what the women's movement and what feminism was out for was to win or to be more powerful, not simply as powerful or comparably powerful here and there in some areas, if not in all, you know, is part of an anti-feminist line of argument that has gotten women and the women's movement in manipulated trouble in the past. And that's part of why people reacted the way they do to Hannah Rosen's article. I want to push back on that a little bit. But I think that the next thing that we're talking about, it seems pretty clear, because I will not argue with you that men have certainly suffered more economically in this recession and in terms of job loss than women have. We now, for the first time in history, have more women employed than men. That is a radical shift. I don't think that's a sign of men's irrelevance. It's a sign of the sectors of the economy that have failed in the past couple of years, happen to be male-dominated sectors. It is also certainly symptomatic of decades worth of women's progress and lots more women being in the workplace. The question of balancing family and work seems to be what both of us may be pushing toward talking about now.
Yeah.
I know that in the National Review today, was it today?
I think Catherine Jean Lopez? I think it was today.
Recently, within the past couple days, Catherine Jean Lopez has written a column about the mommy wars, which we can talk about, because this is certainly an issue at the heart of the Rosen piece, at the heart of so much of what we talk about, at the heart of what we talk about when we talk about Sarah Palin. It's like a Hemingway story. What are your thoughts on how this balance that you're talking about, women being super women, though I also think that's kind of, for my money, that's often another thing, like women wanting to have it all is often a false thing that's put out there. I don't really know that many women who want to have it all. They just want a lot more than had been previously available to them.
I agree with that. I object to that phrase usually. I think it's kind of a false concept too in a lot of regards. What that ultimately means, I think this goes back to the point that I was trying to make in the blog her piece. I think what women want is not one particular thing. I don't think you can look at millions or billions of people who all have, you know, the same chromosome. I don't think you can look at them and say, well, this is what they want, this is what they all want, this is what the majority of them want even. That's very complicated, and so whether you're looking at the superwoman concept or whether you're looking at, you know, women really prefer to be stay-at-home moms or women really want to be out in the workplace excelling on a professional level, I don't think that there's any sort of uniformity there. And I thought the main thing that grabbed my attention about the piece and caused me to read it actually was the introduction where she's talking about what happens if you go to a cocktail party and you're a woman and somebody asks what you do and you say, I stay at home with the kids, and then you get sort of the silent treatment. Ironically, I sort of read that as a woman who does not have kids and actually, frankly, doesn't see a lot of immediate interest in having kids. I've had exactly the opposite experience of that. And I think, you know, perhaps what's interesting about that is I think it ties back to this point about women in some cases being very judgmental about other women and very much sort of, you know, if you don't believe what I believe and if you don't conform to what I think, then you're not, you know, you're not up to my standard, you're not really a woman, you're not whatever, insert a label. And I don't know, I think that that's something that's generally fairly toxic. I think where the piece ultimately gets to is talking about how oftentimes women want different things at different points in their lives, depending on where they're at. If you have a 2-year-old, probably your objectives are a little bit different professionally than perhaps what your objectives are if you have a 15-year-old. And I think, by and large, that probably is true. And ultimately, that's something that's a little bit hard to grapple with, both in terms of sort of personal planning and in terms of public policy, frankly, because we are looking at a lot of flexibility being necessary.
I thought one of the things that was interesting about the Lopez piece is that she uses Palin as an example of what you're talking about, the sort of flexibility going from PTA mom to governor of her state in X numbers of years. And she uses it as part of the argument about, you know, her argument about at certain points women may want to stay home with their kids, at certain points they may want to work. You know, I see Palin in part as one of the great advertisements for the increasingly more equitable distribution of domestic work, because it's always been clear that Sarah Palin has had this husband who has been domestically cooperative and has gone pretty halfsies with her on raising their five kids.
I think that's entirely true. Yep.
And that's something that we, and by the way, that's the only way you get in a, if you're a married mother of five, four, when you enter the governor's mansion, that's the only way you get into the governor's mansion when you're 42. And that model would have been pretty impossible to imagine, really, even 10 years ago, I gotta say. I've said this about Sarah Palin before, even though I so deeply and vehemently disagree with her on everything. I've often said before that Sarah Palin has been incredibly valuable to this country in that she is a member of a new generation of young women entering politics, even when they have young families. Doesn't mean she didn't get questioned on the, you know, the quality of her maternal skills and will she be able to take care of her kid. I mean, she faced all that too. But it is, again, expanding our vision of what a female leader can look like and where in her life she can be when she becomes a hardworking and full-time, you know, governor.
I agree with that. And I thought, just to interject really quickly, when Sarah Palin was nominated for the vice presidential slot, I was at the Republican National Committee, so I was in a position where I had a lot of incoming thoughts about that being sent in my direction. And one of the things that I did find interesting was the female friends that I have who really are very high-flying from a career perspective, and they do want families, but they do not want to, they don't want to take maternity leave. They don't want to be at home for a couple of years. One of the things that I found fascinating was that finally there was somebody who was very prominent who would step forward in public life who actually gave them a model to replicate. And that was a lot of the feedback that I heard. So, yeah, I think that she's definitely a very prominent example of that. And I think you're right. As a 42-year-old woman with many, many children, it's hard to imagine how you would actually enter the governor's mansion unless you did have a stay-at-home husband.
Men have been entering governor's mansions at 42 with five children for a very long time because they had wives.
Because they have stay-at-home wives, that's right.
Yes, yeah. And if they have, and I guess it's not fair, Todd wasn't stay-at-home, it was that they really, I mean, Todd has worked as well, but they really did split domestic duties, as far as I can tell from the reporting on them. I mean, who knows? I don't know that. But they really do seem to have a very equitable domestic relationship, which is, as many people before me, including Leslie Bennett and Linda Hirschman and many people have pointed out, is one of the last frontiers of feminism. Because as long as the domestic burdens are not, or the domestic expectations are not equal, when it comes not only to childcare, but also with cleaning and cooking, and that doesn't mean that women shouldn't cook and clean. It means that they should cook and clean at a sort of equal rate and with an equal responsibility to their if they're heterosexual to their male partners. And that ultimately is my problem with Lopez's article, is that it's all about how women want different things at different times in their lives, and there are moments when they want to stay home with their kids, there are moments when they want to focus on their careers, and can't we get past that, and can't we get past the judgment of women who decide to stay at home with their children? And all that is perfectly fine, but my entire problem is not with judging women who stay home with their kids. It's with the assumption that it's women who want to stay home with their kids.
Yeah, I agree with that. I wholeheartedly agree with that. I'm one of these sort of peculiar types who, actually, for as much as I just talked about some of my female friends, more of my friends are men. And overwhelmingly, I think if you looked at my closest male friends and surveyed them, I think that you would find that the majority of them would love to be a stay-at-home dad.
Yes.
Would love it. And actually, that's something that's presenting something of a challenge for them, you know, meeting women who have objectives that actually, you know, jive with that, for lack of a better term.
Right, because you actually need somebody, if your desire is to stay at home, you need somebody who can support you.
Yeah, you need a corporate lawyer who's on partner track. You do.
Right.
That's what you need. Yeah, and sometimes finding that isn't that easy. Yeah.
I just had this conversation this weekend. It's very funny. You know, my brother is a stay-at-home dad.
Mm-hmm.
He actually writes about it. And it was, you know, it was an economic and a practical decision for their family, and he really loves it. It wasn't his goal to be a stay-at-home dad, but he loves it. It was, in fact, as one parent staying at home has long been, the economic choice. This weekend, my husband and I were at brunch with friends who were talking about, you know, their future plans and, you know, that whatever happens, the man in the couple was likely to stay home with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing, because there are men who, as Catherine Jean Lopez points out about women, when their kids are small, would like to, or it makes more sense for them to stay home if they have a lower salary. I happen to know a lot of couples where the women make that higher salary. I think it might just be, I mean, clearly now that's also part of a larger national recession-influenced trend. That's about unemployment and joblessness, not about, you know, varying salary levels. But it becomes increasingly possible for there to be an economic situation where maybe both parents feel about equally about staying home, but one has the larger salary. And
right.
And that's been historically one of the reasons it's been very unfair that it's always fallen to women, because historically men have always had the larger salaries, or in almost all cases. So
right.
it would make no economic sense to do the reverse. But now, and again, I don't want to overstate and say, well, now all women make more than men. That's simply not true. That's simply a manipulation. It's slowly catching up. But as it does, the choice of who's going to stay home, if you happen to be in a family situation where you feel strongly as a family that there should be one parent at home, it will slowly become more of a real choice between which parent it is.
I think that's right. I agree with you. I mean, I think ultimately what we're seeing is not necessarily movement consistently in one direction or another in terms of men and women's preferences, but there is a much more mixed and muddled picture. And I do think that that is probably actually in most cases beneficial. I think that there's more scope for people to do the thing that they personally feel more comfortable doing and that they're more dedicated to doing. And that can only be a positive. But yeah, I think ultimately things are a lot more muddled than what I think a lot of these pieces that are being written necessarily depict. And I think that's good. And frankly, I think that it's something that we should all, on some level, I hesitate to say celebrate because it sounds like, you know, a little bit over-enthusiastic, but it's something that I think we should all be glad about. I mean, at the end of the day, ultimately, we want people to be happy, right? So that's going to mean that, you know, your brother is going to be happiest being at home with the kids, great. Why not, right?
Right. Well, we want people to be happy, and we want them to be able to have the flexibility to make choices, whether or not it makes them happy. Yes, we'd like everybody to be happy, but given that, pure contentment is not always instantly attainable.
Maybe better said, moves them in that direction, presents greater prospects for something like that.
And allows them to get by in the best and most practical way possible. Allows them to, earn enough money and raise their families and make it through. And I think that, you know, when you fall short of happiness, it's often about making it work. And what we need are flexible arrangements so that there can be lots of different configurations in which it can work, and that those configurations don't always rely on one sex, historically women, being the ones to have to make a certain set of choices. There are more flexible options for both sexes, and we can even it out a little bit.
Yep. I totally agree with that. I'm wondering, though, one thing that we haven't really touched upon as much is we talked a little bit about women candidates this cycle, but I didn't know if you wanted to jump back, given that we're talking about sort of choices that are being made and options that are being presented to people of both genders. I didn't know if you wanted to jump back and talk a little bit about this year of the woman stuff and what the actual implications of that may or may not be.
Well, it depends on what happens, right? I mean,
right.
Again, there was the LA Times article suggesting that the year of the woman may result with fewer women in Congress than there have been. That the implications of that would not be good, as far as I'm concerned. I think, though, again, I oppose all the, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I'm left of most Democrats. I don't agree with any of the Republican women who are running on, 90% of what they say, 99% of what they say. That said, I am somebody who also believes that progress takes all sorts. And one of the things that I've sort of realized in my reporting, especially about presidential politics the past few years, but also about women in politics in general, is that we have... Many of us carry around these visions of what a woman candidate should look like, what a woman mm-hmm. leader should look like, and they're often really idealized versions because there have been so few women, and it's been, and the idea of having female leaders has for a long time, or was for a long time, really the stuff of fantasy, not reality. And so we have these ideas, you know, certainly women on the left have them, about the fantasy female leader. And it was something that Hillary Clinton really ran up against when she started her campaign, yeah. and she wasn't the fantasy leader of many women on the left, because she'd had to do a lot of compromising in order to get close to the presidency.
Yeah.
So, but I think we really need to get over those idealized fantasies. And part of that is accepting that female candidates come in all shapes and sizes and all ideologies. They come from the left and the right, and they're smart and they're stupid and they're corrupt and they're clean. And if we are to move closer, slowly, closer to real political equality, gender equality, you're going to see women of all stripes. That's part of it. There have long been men of all stripes and all degrees of quality.
Yeah.
So in that regard, you know, from a great distance, I think it's terrific that all these Republican women are running.
Right.
I wish that the Democratic Party was throwing, this is what my op-ed was about, I wish the Democratic Party was throwing a lot more energy around putting lots more women of all shapes, sizes, and stripes front of us.
This is actually part of why I wanted to just jump back to it, though, because one of the things that I had thought, and I couldn't really figure out a way to touch on this previously in our conversation, but one of the things that I really thought when I was reading that piece is, they talk about things by reference to Congress, and I'm not in any way disputing the importance of Congress. My firm consults for candidates who are running for federal office. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I think that it's important.
Right.
But one of the things that I thought was a little bit discounted in that piece or a little bit underplayed, and I don't know what you think about this, was actually women running for governor.
Oh.
I felt like there wasn't attention being paid to that, and I thought that was strange because it's an executive office. And actually there, I feel like on both sides of the aisle, we do have some fairly prominent,
we have New Mexico.
We have New Mexico in both cases, that's right.
And Oklahoma, right? Is it Oklahoma?
Oklahoma, and we also have Florida with Alex Sink.
Yeah.
On the Democratic side of the aisle, and then of course shifting back to the Republicans with Republican Year of the Woman or whatever, you know, you have Mae Whitman, you have, as you said, both candidates in New Mexico, and you also have Nikki Haley. So
yes.
I think that's part of the picture that maybe a little bit of focus should be placed on, because Congress is all very well and good, but you're looking at 435 of them, you're looking at a wave, I mean, that's going to shift one direction or another, just depending on whatever the political circumstances are. I think that it's perhaps a less individualized office than governor is in many regards.
Yes.
And so I think it's actually, the point may be correct in terms of the numbers, but I think in terms of looking at the trend in its totality, I think it may be a little bit misplaced because I think it's not putting a great deal of emphasis on looking at women just like those that we've mentioned, who I think are probably actually, by virtue of running for governor, maybe
yeah.
setting themselves up better for future presidential runs.
Well, I think that point is very well taken. And in fact, there are lots of people. There's a woman named Barbara Lee, who's a philanthropist in Boston, who mm-hmm. runs the Barbara Lee Family Foundation and has sponsored studies of female governors. And the kind of, she believes in part that that's the chief path eventually to presidential power for women, because it is executive office.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very individualized office, and, you know, it's very interesting ideas on this subject. And so I agree with you. That point is well taken. It wasn't included in the piece for a couple of reasons. First, simply for space, is, you know, when you're writing an op-ed, you're not getting into actually very many details. But also because part of it was that, I mean, the Democrats have some terrific female governors. I mean, I know this is not a presidential prospect, but Jennifer Granholm, I mean, there are some really dynamic Democratic women running for governor, who are governors, and so I think you're very right about that. But again, what has to happen is that the party, the op-ed was not so much to suggest that that there aren't Democratic women out there. It's that
right.
the party has to embrace and give them a serious platform. That's what happened with Palin. Obviously, it happened with Palin in a kind of out-of-control manner. I don't think anybody thought they were giving her the platform that she's wound up taking. But
I think I can wholeheartedly agree with that, yes.
I don't think it
although
was
she definitely embraced it.
Right, she stepped up. So, but it's a question of, you know, putting women front and center, those, you know, either gubernatorial candidates or governors, and saying, hey, this is what the future of our party looks like, in part. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very tricky to say, how do you do that, when do you do that, but what I can say is that the Democrats so far have not done that.
Yeah, I think that that's probably largely correct. But like I say, I still remain interested in what's going to go on with the New Mexico governor's race and also with that Florida governor's race. I think that I'm a big fan of Susana Martinez running in New Mexico, so I'll just throw that out there. But I think that Alex Sink in particular is somebody who I have a real sense has been a little bit underestimated, and we'll
right.
see if I'm right or wrong in my prediction about that. But I think there are interesting characters out there, and we'll see if perhaps they step forward and get a little bit more support in doing so.
Well, we'll see what happens in those races. The woman-on-woman race, which is often fetishized in the most depressing way possible as kind of like cat fights or hair pulls or whatever, actually is so progressive and interesting to me. This is, you know, what's going on in New Mexico. There's also there have been other races, not necessarily gubernatorial races this season, that have been two women against each other. And this is actually part of what the future is going to look like if women mm-hmm. are to get closer. I mean, we don't bat an eye when it's a man-man race, right? Like,
right.
That's the norm.
That seems
and
very
it
common,
still
yeah.
remains so unusual to see a woman campaigning against another woman mm-hmm. that, again, we fetishize it and, you know, laugh and giggle and, you know, make pillow fight jokes or whatever. But this is, to me, one of the most interesting things about this season is that we have these races, and they're going to become more and more common if, in fact, more and more women get into the political process.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right.
Yeah. All right. Is there anything else we want to go over?
I don't think so. I mean, if there's anything that you want to add.
No, I think we've covered a lot of territory.
I do, too.
All right.
All right, well, it was great talking with you.
It was a real pleasure. Have a good day.
You too.
Bye.